3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome to TYH podcast on TRS Radio. My name is Anglo, and with me I have my normal co-host, Nike.
Hello.
And then we have my friend, Damster. How you doing?
Thanks for having me on. We've had you on EBL a couple times. It's good to switch over and join your show and meet your friend Nico here.
Yep. He's my swarthy Greek friend.
Jesus.
Swarthy.
But I think this is Tyler. Do you want to just explain what EBL is? I mentioned it before, but it'd obviously be good if you, the leader of EBL, would talk about it. So.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. Well, EBL stands for the Euro Bureau of Literature, which is quite an interesting name, I guess. But it was originally just a book club for me that I made at like 2 a.m. because I was bored. And I kind of missed having that undergrad feeling where you're reading all these texts and you're with your group of friends having cigars and beer and thinking that you solved all the world's problems. And so I missed that feeling. So I started that book club online at Twitter and ended up getting like 30-something people interested in it. And so for a while, it was just behind the scenes. It was just chill. But someone suggested, hey, why don't you record this? This is pretty good. So it ended up becoming a YouTube show. And then it got picked up recently by Richard Spencer's NPI Radix channel on YouTube. So now the show's on there if the audience wants to find it. But what we do is we take every week, we take a different reading in the history of philosophy, usually a very complex reading, and we break it down for the audience so they have the tools to understand the text and so that they could wield them in their own, you know, investigations of various things around the world. So it's partly educational, but it's also so that we could have productive conversations on going forward for the dissident right into the future and what kind of strategies and ideas we should take with us. So it's both educational, but it's also a productive endeavor. And it finds new and interesting voices as well and brings together some higher agency types that might have been somewhat missing during the big tent 2016 time with all the libertarian baggage. So we're sort of rediscovering a more radical version of the dissident right that's not easily placed into the left-right paradigm and can offer a more productive challenge to the global system that we live in.
Nice. Yeah, you guys right should on. Definitely check it out. I've been on, I think, 2 episodes, and now I'm like, I'll leave it to you guys to do the big brain stuff because I'm still learning a lot, but it was fun. There's a lot of good conversations. What was the last episode on?
The last one, oh, by the way, I'll make you come back on at some point, regardless of whether or not you say you're not going to come back, I will make you. But we did the last one was actually just me and Josh Neal by myself. And we did Walter Benjamin's
that was good episode.
Thesis on the concept of history, which is partly more of a theological text. It's more of a criticism of historical materialism, but also in a way offers like a corrective of it by using strong theological concepts to attack the idea of linear progressive time and to sort of cleanse radical politics from merely repeating the same direction that the neoliberal paradigm does, and you know, when it risks subsuming all resistance to it and makes it something a part of the system it's trying to overthrow. And so the premise of the work, which is only 11 pages, very small, but there's a lot of meat in it, is basically to cleanse the progressive view out of radical politics and to insert it with what's called divine violence, which is basically a theological judgment on the world that counteracts the progressive view of time with a interrupting or a radical time where it puts all of our accepted understandings and our economy of desire into question as a judgment. So that way the work of politics could always be radically renewed and rethought, and to shift our desires away from being satisfied by the system in the sense that we don't merely become a part of the same thing that we're trying to overthrow.
Unfortunately, my laptop crashed at this moment in the recording, so a lot of big brain discussion was lost. Damn, this shit sucks.
Hentai, though, so.
Well, that's divine, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. You guys can hear more
about
that.
And if you want to catch more,
hit it up on
You can
Radix.
Find him at his... Yes.
On the YouTube channel. Nice. So, Nikkei, do you have the comments open from the last episode?
I do.
You want to go over some of the notable ones?
Sure. Let's go sort from oldest to...
Not to be rude to the audience, but like if it's like, I don't know. If it sucks,
we've got
we could ignore it.
Tweemo, and he says, philosophy is gay, dudes. Grugs will inherit civilization. I only need to know four things. Jew bad. White good. Christ is king. Biggest stick wins. When our good friend Tam interjects that big rock, big stick. An important caveat.
You got any questions? You got any answers to that? I guess we could go to the general topic of what's the value of philosophy for the distant right? Because I think sometimes people may not recognize it, or they oh, it's just navel gazing and just like semantics. What's the point? Can you make a case for philosophy? I guess.
A quick sounds comment weird, but... on that. The comment there was interesting. Christ is king, but also guy with bigger stick wins. But I mean, that's also not very much a statement someone that would say Christ is king should make. Because ultimately, the whole reason Christ was actually killed by the Jews is because they were expecting a Messiah that was going to come in and overthrow Rome with violence and establish a Jewish kingdom that would rule over Gentiles. And the reason that they killed Christ is because he... basically came like a pacifist, right? But it wasn't a pacifism where it's without political resistance. That's why you read things like turn the other cheek. What that actually was a way to shame the person who's slapping you, because it would mean they would have to slap you like a woman would slap you, right? And so it would be shaming the imperial authority by nonviolence as opposed to violently overthrowing the current order. Hmm. Or it's the same thing with like if someone carries your bit, if you carry the bag for somebody, carry it another mile. That was another way of shaming the Roman soldier, because it was basically saying they're too much of a bitch to carry it themselves. So you're making them look weak, right? But so the whole idea of early Christianity was largely this other kingdom of God that is judging the world much in the way we were talking about Walter Benjamin, but it does it with weakness, right? Hmm. So it's nonetheless, it is a radical form of politics, but it's not politics where someone who says Christ and King should say the bigger stick following it. So that's my first question. Sorry, my first comment on that there. But as for philosophy, the case for it, well, I mean, there's a lot of ways we could talk about this. Yeah. But the first one is one of the things that philosophy does is it clarifies concepts, and it clarifies where various concepts or meanings come from, or for example how they're used in language, right? Like I was having a conversation yesterday about the word liberty, and so we all know liberty from within the American context, right? It means negative liberty. It means the freedom to do what you want. And then, you know, the justification for that is usually, oh, if as long as you don't harm anybody, which of course is bullshit because negative externality exists. But nonetheless, we become so bewitched by language that when you're trying to start a political movement, you're trying to reach out to people, you're fundamentally operating within a certain language that's given to you in a time, and that language comes from a set of imperatives from the state, and it becomes something which is given top down, but nonetheless it informs your current reality, so that everything you say, you're thinking through these concepts, right? Whether you usually you don't realize it, it's just something that's normal. And so what ends up happening is a lot of the things that you want to affirm is something you're affirming from within that paradigm that you're trying to overthrow. And so if you lack the philosophical skills to actually, and I'll use this word, I'm sure it'll be controversial, but nonetheless, to deconstruct, if you don't do that work, you're going to find yourself having this problem where who you're trying to appeal to or what you're trying to construct is going to end up operating from within the same parameters set up by the system, and so ultimately your resistance becomes futile. And you can see this throughout the whole history of the dissident right. You look at the 80s, the moral majority, right? They voted for Reagan. They throw their lot in with conservatism. They try to operate their Christian resistance to the liberal paradigm, like when it came to issues of abortion and stuff like that. And they threw their weight behind Ronald Reagan. They're like, okay, well, there's conservatism here. They're operating within the same language. We can make moral claims through the GOP. And of course, what ended up happening is all that resistance got completely subsumed back into the GOP machine. And their resistance just became weaker and weaker until there was something gone. And this happened in the 90s, of course, with Patrick Buchanan and the paleo conservatives. So the issue of clarifying where meaning comes from and how the state orders that is absolutely crucial work to any dissident movement. So that's one way in which philosophy is essential. The other way is understanding the history of philosophy. You have to understand why we have certain ideas and where that they came from. So, for example, we all hear cultural Marxism is bad, right? But, and whether or not you fully buy that, because obviously it's more complex, the truth of that is more complex. I overly think cultural Marxism is bad, but the story is not the way it's usually presented on the right. But let's just go ahead and assume it's as bad as the meme presents. If you don't bother to understand that history, you're not going to be able to understand why they were so successful and do the work of excavating where these ideas come from and how they come to dominate and where they gain their power and how you could insert your own twist of the narrative and subvert it back, then, again, you're not really going to get anywhere. The last one would be, I would say, when it comes to the creation or the positive work of philosophy, where we're trying to create something beyond liberalism, something to transcend it, something where, say, for example, we take power tomorrow and we fulfill all the things we want to do. We stop mass immigration, whatever. I don't need to go through all the list. We all know. But nonetheless, that's not going to guarantee you that we're not going to end up reproducing the same conditions that lead to deaths of despair, like with the opioid epidemic, the suicide epidemic, because we haven't dealt with, say, the problems that come with meaning, like with the proliferation of technology, the technological worldview that we live in, what makes us happy, what defines who we are. So you need the work of philosophy to actually construct a new political identity and to, at the same time, rediscover who we are, but do the work of putting who we are towards the future into something positive, which is something I think Europeans in particular have that burden, because we have that Faustian spirit that gave rise to the great scientific achievements and the cultural achievements that we have, but it's managed to make its way around the world to such a point that everyone else is playing catch up. And of course, with the subversion of the Jews on their side to essentially remove us from those positions of power. But rather than, but they don't want equality of outcome. They want to simply take our place in running that system. So what that means is uniquely our burden to come up with something that moves beyond the current paradigm. And that's the positive work in philosophy that you absolutely need philosophy to do. So that's not to say you don't need on the ground organizing and networking. You need to learn how to bodybuild. You need to train. You need to learn how to fight. You need to learn how to start employment networks and things like that. You need to be entirely concrete and on the ground. But at the same time, if you don't do the crucial work of philosophy, both critical, genealogical, and positive, then ultimately we're not really going to end up creating something that's going to be better for us. In fact, our paradigm might not be powerful enough. Like, we look around right now with the crisis of neoliberalism, what's appealing to people? Well, you have like radical, you have Islam, you have post-human developments and like under transhumanism, you have the dissident left. There's all these ideals that are competing to take the place of what's going to happen when neoliberalism exhausts its thought entirely and puts itself into question. And where it stands, we're not really going to win, because we don't actually have much to offer outside of critiques, right? Of critiques of the system or what we don't like. So we need to construct, with the aid of philosophy, the notion of who we are and who we want our people to be going forward, and how we can actually positively transform the world, which is uniquely our burden. And it always has been the burden of Europeans to do so.
You brought up a good point about people needing the skill to, I guess, critique the current paradigm. And people kind of do it implicitly. Like, I hear people talk about, we need to reject the modern world and modernity. But then these are the same people that will say, like, oh, philosophy is a waste of time. But, like,
strange thing to say. I mean, if you think about it, if you're opposed to modernity, what characterizes modernity the most is efficiency and speed. Everything is like it's like an eternal present, right? Like, you, everything is given to you at once. People have no sense of past or future. It's like you grow up on Snapchat or Instagram or whatever the fuck kids use, and like, it's like inhabiting this dopamine system, and it's always the next thing. And this happens within dissident movements too. Like, I see people change their political identity monthly, like one month I'm Nazbol, next time the hoaxes, I don't know. You see, you know what I'm talking about. It's very trendy when it comes to political identity. Well, and so what ends up happening,
that's a big internet effect there.
It is.
It's also like the Facebook effect, where in Facebook you can just change what you identify as. You can go and change your political views section, and that's like,
I used to do that when I was 13. I would just go like, okay.
Like, when you change your religious views or your political affiliation, that's the action that defines who you are. When you change it on Facebook, then you've changed who you are.
Yeah, like when I was 13, I remember changing my political views, because I don't know if it still does this, but like, 1 month I was a liberal, classical liberal, and then I'm like, you know what, I think I'll be an anarcho-communist. Then the next month I was an anarcho-syndicalist. And I thought that was that was a big statement, and I was really changing things.
And, I remember being a very proud middle schooler with his political and religious views so clearly defined in his Facebook bio.
Weren't you like a middle school Stalinist, Nike?
Yes.
He was a neocon Stalinist. Not a neocon Trotskyite, but a neocon Stalinist, which is something very interesting.
It was incoherent and middle schoolish. Yeah. It sort of boiled down to, I had the psychological damage of 9/11 as a young child imprinted on me, and that sort of same attitude reapplied to George Bush, and I guess in a way Joseph Stalin as well.
Yeah, that's funny.
You know, because you're presented with this sort of worldview, I guess you could call it the World War. Some people specify as the Holocaust mythology, but I think it's wider to all the Second World War. Which the Holocaust narrative is a big part of, as presented. But, in the World War II worldview, the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin's, military might is an unqualified good that helped us win. Mm. He's seen as the man who was willing to do anything to win the war. You know, his brutality justified his... was justified by his mission, and that mission was to, save the world or something. And in that same way, George Bush's mission was to save the world from terrorism.
Oh God!
So I think
George Bush, man, steel.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess the take-home message is like, condemning philosophy while being against the modern world is odd, because at the end of the day, contemplation and careful cultivation of what you believe in, it's kind of the exact opposite of the modern world.
Exactly.
The modern world is just, swallowing everything you're given.
I think people think the modern world is just now, like 2020, but,
they think
that like 1950s, they rejected modernity as well, That's their thought.
I give people a little bit more credit.
I know,
but
you gotta admit, there are some people
that's
like
a very
that.
Newcomer.
They're
well, okay, so let's look at what they're doing when they say that. People who come in and say the 1950s is what we need to return to, what they're looking at is primarily, I think, family values, right? A stable home, mm-hmm. And economic prosperity, and implicitly, implicit ethnic homogeneity, to the extent that's true, but it is. That's the way that the 50s are presented. And in many places during the 50s, that was certainly the case. So that's what they see as like the most recent point of reference that, you know, especially if you're American, things were good and it wasn't that long ago. So that makes it easier to return to. You see where that sort of perspective?
No, I understand.
Comes about. Yeah.
I'm just saying that it's more than that. I'm not even faulting those people, because I used to be like that as well. I'm just saying that it's good to, like, you know, orient yourself in a greater, to see what modernity actually is and what it means, you know, and instead of it just being 2020, you know.
I guess people have this perception of their first order needs under threat, which, you know, family unity being one of them.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a job and you don't have a family, then, you know, that's cause for some first order concern.
Yeah. I mean, I get where they're coming from entirely. Like, it's entirely understandable. It's just that it's good to be a little more critical of the 1950s era, because that was largely when consumer mentality took over the role of crafting what the image of the family was, and essentially moving it away from extended family, where you had, you know, your parents, grandparents, and then you had a community where, you know, like, woman, the influence of woman wasn't just to the home, but it was with the community as essentially like moral enforcers, right? Where they had like a role among each other without being actually employed. But it's at the 50s is where you get this this localization of a family into a very specific atomized unit, which is the beginning of the process of atomizing further away from the family as a whole. But it's when consumer identity started to take over important relationships among people and community.
It's also the birth of the suburbs, like the 40s and 50s. You know, you see like ethnic neighborhoods maybe in the cities, like, oh, this is a German neighborhood, this is a whatever neighborhood. Then they moved out to the suburbs and they just became standard American Ameriburgers, mystery meats, you know?
Yeah, sort of like the transition from the 50s to the 70s and the whole civil rights transformation. I mean, that, I think that's what people in that mindset are reluctant to acknowledge.
Yeah,
I think that's the first hurdle there, that rejecting the civil rights bill and the worldview presented by it is
the next thing is to reject the American Revolution.
That's quite a leap, but you know, maybe they get
there. We'll get there one day.
Reject all revolution and go full NRX.
Go to put Urbit on my computer. I don't even know what Urbit is.
Nobody knows what Urbit is.
I had someone try to explain what Urbit was to me, but I just like, I don't think you know what you're saying. I think you're just making
Dude,
it something up.
I've tried to find out what Urbit is, and I legitimately can't. If you asked me to tell you what Urbit is, I wouldn't feel comfortable just saying what I've learned, because it's, I don't feel it adequate as an answer. It doesn't actually, like, if I repeated what I learned, it wouldn't actually answer your question. Just tell us what it is, Mold Bug.
What's Urbit?
No, you keep talking about it and I still don't know what it is.
It's in hip hop.
What'd you say?
It's sweatpants in hip hop.
That's Urbit.
Damn it.
Is that like an actual company, or is that just, that'd be cool if there's like an Urbit company that made like,
there's
streetwear.
Urbit Outfitters.
Urbit Outfitters. I remember when Urban Outfitters, they started like, you guys remember when the vinyl trend started to come back, like maybe 10 years ago, maybe 7 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Urban Outfitters were like one of the first like chain stores to like have a vinyl section in their store.
Dude, and, yeah, it's like these clothes stores picking up like American Eagle.
Does American Eagle have a vinyl section now?
It's either American Eagle or American Apparel.
Yeah, I think it's American Apparel. No, I think it's, I don't know. I haven't been to like a mall or something in a long time. But let's go back to the questions, and then we'll. Ian Moon says, "Hello, fellow Zoomers." And yes, I'm a Zoomer, totally. Even though I'm probably a late millennial, but I don't tell anyone that.
That's okay. I'm there with you, Ian.
Yeah. I just beat up Nikkei because he's a dirty Zoomer, and I'm a millennial Chad. even though we're like 6 months apart.
Something like that.
The difference between 95 and 96 is big.
Oh, shit. Is a generational analysis doing a modernism?
Hmm?
Did we accidentally do a modernity by analyzing our generation?
Guilty.
Honk Hogan says, thanks for the shout out, Nibbas. Love your show when you aren't gamer posting. Go build a birdhouse or something. That's actually good
advice.
Build
a birdhouse in Animal Crossing.
That is true. Yes. I know you like Animal Crossing, Thamster, right? Because I heard you've been playing that.
Oh, I love it, man. That's playing with honeys all day.
Yeah, because like, Nikkei and we talked about that, I think, two episodes ago, how we actually think Animal Crossing is based. We like Animal Crossing.
And it is, actually. But I mean, it's a great way to meet women in quarantine. This is when your audience starts to not take me seriously, but
no,
you can build a birdhouse in Animal Crossing.
I disagree. I think everyone's going to take this the most seriously. Meet women on Animal Crossing. Dude, bitches love Animal Crossing.
Hey, did I mention this last episode, but e-girls are selling their nudes on Animal Crossing because you could like...
No!
You can like paint a picture, like pixel picture, and they made like a pixel picture of their boobs and stuff like that.
Haram.
It's like you could, I don't know if you could transfer JPEGs and turn them into like a pixel picture, but they do that and they sell it.
Absolutely and, haram.
Yeah. Lapis Ram says, Asiago face brings to mind Talia Levin.
Ew.
And anyways, great episode, guys. You guys should do a mini deep dive on your philosophical positions next episode.
I like this.
I didn't read that. I didn't really prepare anything. I'm just reading. I like Hegel a lot, which brings us into another concept or another comment from Heidegger 14. He says, "What do you bros think about Hegel? I'm not a fan toward his of his dialectic toward a free constitutional state, which sounds gay, but he makes some good points about civilizational differences in spiritualism. He seems like an anti-Spengler from my basic readings." So, huh.
Is a dialectic not cyclical? I guess not. It's like a...
See, I haven't done a deep...
The motion of a photon, which is, you know, both in a straight line and a wave.
I haven't done a deep dive on Spengler. Like, I've read a decent amount of The Decline of the West, but I haven't, like, deeply studied him. So I couldn't really say too much comparing the two. Have you read any Spengler, Tyler?
Only like the Prussianism and socialism text. I've been saving on reading Decline of the West just because Arctos is reissuing it. So we're saving it for the EBL series when that comes out. But no, my training in philosophy is more phenomenology and that kind of stuff. So when you said his username was Heidegger, I got excited for a second. I would have been able to talk a lot. But no, that was about Hegel. Of course, that's for whether or not Hegel.
Heidegger, Hegel.
Would you say, Nikkei?
I was going to say, whether Hegel's cyclical, he's certainly not, but the interpretation of Hegel's dialectic varies from the kind of Hegelian you are, left Hegelian, right Hegelian, Zizek's version of Hegel's pretty interesting, but yeah. Maybe another time when we get to Hegel, we can do an EBL series on him.
Yeah, that'd be nice. And yeah, me and Hegel, I don't know too much either. I've read some of the phenomenology, but I'm currently reading a book on Hegel, so I don't think I'm really equipped to answer your question in a detailed manner yet. Maybe in a few weeks, months, years, who knows. But that is cool. Arctos is re-releasing Decline of the West. That's actually really exciting because it's hard to find like the unabridged version. Physically, because I can't read PDFs. I mean, I can. I use my Kindle, but it's really exciting that they're actually getting a physical copy of the unabridged Decline of the West out there. Because I actually was able to find a physical copy, but it's like so old and worn that it's annoying to read, and I feel like it's gonna break every time I use it. So it's exciting news for us book nerds out there. But let's see. Craig McDermott. I enjoyed the bants at the end. I'm too grug brain for philosophy. No, don't feel bad. Like philosophy, it's if you're not into it, it's fine. It doesn't make you any less of a person. I don't want to give that impression. It's you know.
He's talking about our uncle's book.
Yeah, but what's five? What's the five translation? That's what I want to know. Maybe there's something I don't know. Maybe there's a.
Could be a typo.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry.
I don't know what it's supposed to mean, but or supposed
what
to mean.
Supposed
but
to meant.
Yeah, now.
But in our last comment is from Vadhash Daska, one of our good friends, mentions about the Cocteau Twins reprints. He said that they aren't too bad, and I should check them out. So, yeah, I'll do it. Anyways, I want to ask you, Tyler, another question. So you used to be a Marxist, right?
For a good 6 years.
It sounds somewhat similar to me. I was a middle school Marxist myself. I didn't read too much theory. I didn't go too deep into philosophy. I imagine you did. Did you go more deep into theory?
Oh, yeah. Like, I was big into... obviously Marx, but Althusser well. Yeah. Zizek, Badiou, quite heavily, Alberto Toscano, kinds of them, really. Well, Badiou is pretty interesting. He's one of the few philosophers now who's a philosopher in the old style, in the sense that he presents a systematic entire philosophy from the metaphysics all the way down to the ethics, with an axiom that he sets up as the basis for the whole of his philosophy coming out of set theory. And mathematics, and using that to describe being as a multiple rather than as a one, which is a way of saying there's a multiplicity of situations, kind of like you have different sets in set theory, but there's always something with outside the set that gives the name of the set, basically, and that you have these various ruptures into multiplicities from outside the possible coordinates that multiplicity allows. And what that does is create a truth procedure where a militant or a zealot, or if we're talking about romantic love or ethics or aesthetics, would be a different kind of truth procedure. But nonetheless, you could think of it in an easy way with look at like 2015, 2016 alt-right, where you had this growth and realization of white identity outside of coordinates of the system. Now, that doesn't mean every single person all of a sudden adopts that, but it means it creates a certain militant attitude where you gain fidelity to that truth, and it creates a political subject.
Is that the event? So that's the basis. Is that what it was called? It's called the...
But it was pretty interesting in that regard.
So what made you like give up on Marxism? I think this is very interesting.
Well, pretty long-winded story, but it was basically when I first started reading philosophy, I first read Sartre, Being and Nothingness. Mm-hmm. And then I read about his Marxist views, and I became more enamored with Marxism and started reading a lot of the classical Marxist texts and adopting a lot of Marxist viewpoints, and Kate became a full-on Marxist. And then I went to do my undergrad, and I was doing a double in theology and philosophy. And this was around the same time the whole SJW thing became a big thing. And so, of course, as a good classical Marxist, I was against that stuff, because for me, what matters was the economic base that produced those kinds of antagonisms. So I became quite critical of the liberal left in a lot of ways. But then Marxism itself started to become unfulfilling for me, primarily actually from a theological perspective, because I started reading post-liberal theologians like Hans Frey, George Lindbeck. And so I started adopting a more radical anti-modern outlook coming out of theology and rejecting Marxism altogether. And so what ended up happening is, where that led to the dissident right, is at the time I was very involved in black metal, and a lot of friends were also NS. They started introducing me to the dissident right. They started introducing me to Evelyn, you know, the whole laundry list of names, Jonathan Bowden and all that stuff. And then I found a lot of commonalities between that thinking and the post-liberal theology that I was reading. And then at the same time, of course, you had worsening of white scapegoating and blood libel against whites, and it became quite the transformation. But I ended up becoming anti-Marxist and ended up becoming full-on pro-white, and but also still retaining a lot of the radical theological views I had and bringing them into conversation to where I am today. But it's been quite a journey because I never thought I would end up here. But I think that's true for a lot of us, regardless of why we came here.
Yeah, for me, I was like, I wanted to be a, when I was like 15, I wanted to be a crust punk anarcho-communist. And I literally remember telling myself the last thing in my life I want to be is a Nazi. If I ever turn into a Nazi, I should like kill myself. Like, that's how bad I was. And then now I'm like, oh, never mind.
It's so easy to say that when you're just, you know.
When you're like 15,
full into the worldview, you know? It's like.
Well, it's because you take it in. And it's not even to say like I'm a hardcore NS, but I'm just saying like, to me, like Nazi meant anything, even like a Jared Taylor was a Nazi, you know? So to me, it was the last thing I wanted to be. And also because like, I think a lot of Germans maybe feel this because although I call myself Anglo, I'm Anglo-German. Like my grandmother's from Germany. I was raised in German culture, like adjacent to German culture. And there's always this attempt to like try to say, well, you know, we're not Nazis, we're Germans. And so like, I always had that kind of weird complex about it. Like, I always was like this weird, almost like reconstructed anti-Nazi, you know, due to American propaganda where it was like totally reactive and non-productive. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, well, it never stops amazing me, really, where I am now. Like, I can't imagine if myself, an undergrad, as a naive first-year Marxist, would think encountering myself now, like, knowing, like, later on I'd be, like, getting retweeted by, like, David Duke. Like, it's such a fucking strange feeling, man. Like...
Yeah,
like I don't mean that in like a celebrity way. I mean like that's just my reality. No, it's just weird. Like,
isn't it fun though? It's fun that reality is like this, and we could do that, and we have this transformation, and we get closer to what we.
It is definitely weird when you know former head of the Klan is retweeting you.
Yeah, right?
It's like by definition atypical. So few people ever get retweeted by David Duke that you know you can't help even but see yourself as. In part of this, you know, limited circle of people who've ever had this experience, whether they liked it or disliked it.
What goes along with that is the way previous idols just become losers. Like I mentioned earlier, like my first reading was Stephen King and I love those stories. But now I just find myself like making fun of him on Twitter and calling him a faggot. it's like weird. It's like things that you looked up to just totally reverse, right? And then you realize how stupid elites are and how stupid things that you look up to actually is. Like it's this aura around them, like these people are holier than thou, they're accomplished, they wrote great books or make great movies or make great music, and then now you look at them like, you know, you're kind of a fag.
Yeah.
what did you think of The Stand?
I liked the book. Actually, I thought the miniseries wasn't bad either.
I haven't been able to see the miniseries, but
I haven't read any.
Went through
King,
the whole unabridged Stand, and I liked it.
Yeah, I haven't read any King. I know my mom was a big fan, though. She read The Stand and all everything.
Yeah, the weirdest part about Stand is just he does this. King will do this thing where he just inserts this zero context, you know, homoerotic chapter into his books. And or it's just like, shut the fuck up, dude.
Zero context child orgy scene?
Yeah, no, he's just like, he inserts this.
I did not even know that.
And like, from his other chapters, you know how, you know that he understands how to insert like normal sexuality into a book. And then he totally diverges from that for like one chapter in his books. And I don't know if it's just because... I don't know.
Well, look at him, like, physiognomy. I mean, in a weird, like... I mean, he doesn't look as bad now. But, like, if you look at him in the 80s, he was kind of, like, fat. And he had those very, very thick glasses where his eyes are so small. And you could just, like, tell that this is a weird guy.
Oh, shit. Was Harold the self-insert in The Stand?
Maybe.
Oop.
Harold.
I think so. That was the...
He's the fat nerd kid who ends up becoming, you know, he finds purpose in working, like, you know, a blue-collar job.
Yeah, I think
so. But then, then betrays everybody when he gets, you know, seduced.
Well, it's so funny about Stephen King is that he's this New England guy that probably lives in a 95% white town, and he's just... He doesn't realize how much of a, you know, kind of what the blessing he has and how most Americans don't live like him.
It also means he doesn't know how to write black people outside of stereotypes.
Yeah, I bet he's never even met one.
Like, his black people are all like, oh, dear mammy.
Yeah. Like, even me, I'm like, damn, that's too racist.
It's not racist. It's just, you know, you can tell detached, he's out of his element, and you can tell he's really trying hard.
You can tell he's from Maine, you know. He's
not a black character. Yes, you can tell he's from Maine.
She's like, oh, there's a storm coming. His storm.
Y'all better get to your honey's in a side.
Yeah.
Let me whip up you some warm grits.
Yeah, Stephen King is actually someone that looks better as they got older, because, like, I think he just lost weight. But I'm not saying he looks good now. He looks like a weird rat. But looks like a Whoville.
He made trash movies like Creepshow and Maximum Overdrive.
So, worst Stephen King book and best in your opinion?
Fuck, I don't know. The one I didn't like when I read it was Cujo.
Never read it.
I like some of the novellas, like The Sun Dog, which wasn't well reviewed, but I liked it. I liked Christine quite a bit. The series is good, of course.
I thought Duma Key was pretty good.
Oh, wow. Is this him?
Which one?
Duma Key. It's about, like, some retiree moving to Florida.
It's about a doomer.
Boomer. Boomer Key.
Yeah, is there any... Let me see. I just want to share you guys this picture of Stephen King back in the day.
Oh, shit. Really?
Is that him? I don't know. Is that...
Oh, yeah.
Bro, I mean, look at that.
What the fuck?
He looks way cooler. He looks like a slasher movie villain.
Yeah, no, he
it
looks
is actually
like,
cool.
Because
this is before he had the glasses, so it looks like a creepy, like, hippie, like, almost, like, biker, you know, you'd see somewhere.
Yeah, no, he looks like the dangerous hippie.
Yeah, yeah, but he's just...
It's like, took way too much psychedelics.
Maybe a little bit of meth.
Meth hippie.
Those did exist, meth hippies.
Yeah,
and those Jesus. Are overlooked. The psychedelic hippies like are now professors. The meth hippies are just
yeah. No physiognomy. I mean, that's so important because like yeah. No, everything just makes so much more sense when you take a look at the guy.
Yeah,
like ah yes, this is why you did that. And I don't know what sort of impulse. I think that is actually evolutionary. Just seeing the way somebody looks and just knowing deep down, like, you know, ugliness is actually bad. If you're an ugly person, you
it's
you
not
might
even
be
really
bad.
Ugly. It's like a certain thing because there are people that are quote unquote like not even that good looking. But
well,
it's something.
Ugliness versus charisma.
Yeah.
Like, it's... ugly people can be charismatic, but they're probably evil.
You must be really evil yeah. then.
Fuck you.
But yeah, I think we got over some of the big brain stuff. Do you have any articles, Nikkei, that I was too lazy to do some prepping because I've been researching all day for project?
Oh, nonsense. Using your time wisely. I've got some hot takes from College Fix.
What is College Fix? Is this one of our...
This is one of our content farms from the conservosphere.
Nice.
We got women's studies lecturer worries a UK-developed COVID-19 vaccine will increase patriotism.
Wait, you cut off a little bit. Did it end at the patriotism bit?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So...
Yeah, that's the one where she's like doesn't want her university to develop a vaccine because it just means like white men would do it again.
Basically, so that's crazy. Let me just read these three paragraphs here. Emily Cousins. That's a weird way to spell that. It's Cousens, and I can only guess that's a weird spelling of the French pronunciation. Cousins.
Who knows?
Anyway, who's working on her PhD in vulnerability and gender and teaches a women's studies course at Oxford Brookes University and the Oxford University, or yeah, the University of Oxford, respectively. She wrote in Huffington Post that she does not want Oxford developing a vaccine because she says... Or because researchers say rich countries will hoard supplies and the UK will prioritize Britain's.
Oh, that's weird.
In addition, Cousins says a successful vaccine will make folks overlook the UK's, quote, devastating delay in reacting to the pandemic, such as Prime Minister Boris Johnson's concerns over things like individual liberty. Quote, we'll forget the lessons that the pandemic has taught so far. That the UK and the US are in fact not exceptions to at the global stage, that we are not only vulnerable but can also afford to learn lessons from countries regardless of whether we have a special relationship with them, such as South Korea, that being white, male, and Oxford educated may not be the only criteria for effective leadership.
Oh.
I mean, this is obviously bullshit.
I mean, there
because
is some, like, yeah,
the leadership
obvious...
that comes out of the U.S. and the U.K. is going to be white and male, and probably educated.
Something in the U.K. you cut out a little bit.
I was just saying, like, she's complaining about something that I think is more or less going to be effectively true no matter what. That even if you do put up a brown whammon,
well,
the
thing
you're
that
still
annoys
going to
me
have
is
white
this
male
idea...
leadership in the inserted
is this idea that like it's like morally wrong that Britons want to like give the vaccine to Britons first, you know?
Yeah, and to say that this is somehow a worthwhile trade-off.
Yeah, just rather like everyone die instead of
let's forego research because it makes white people look good.
Yeah, it's like really weird. Just this, like,
it's like let them die so my message of white people shouldn't be in positions of power or accomplish anything.
Yeah, let people die so I can be right. That's what you're asking. I want to have my worldview affirmed, so just let everyone die.
Did you experience that at all in school? I mean, you did mention some of the SJW stuff that you kind of fought against as a principled classical Marxist, but did you experience any of the like sort of white privilege workshops and stuff like that?
For many, actually. I was in a Christian university, but coming from like the economics department and some segments of the English department and the psychology department, you had stuff like that.
Yeah.
But overly not quite, like the head of the theology department, my mentor, he's vehemently against all that kind of stuff. He even actually watches my streams, which is interesting. But no, he's all in some ways more radical than me, but he shaped that department in such a way that stuff doesn't really happen. And same with the philosophy department, really. Like, we never had that much of that. I had a pretty good environment for learning. And sometimes you get it, though, because we have like a every semester there's a conference where it's a different social issue and they invite outside speakers and
yeah,
it gets like 1,000 people there and whatever. And then you hear some of that shit slipping in there, but overly, it wasn't something I had to deal with too much where I felt stifled. But there's certainly things I couldn't say, of course, which is interesting with the whole systemic thing where, you know, minorities in teaching positions or even just liberal leftists, which is more common. Mm-hmm. Liberal leftist whites, they'll push back on you stronger for anything that you say, which is reasonable. Like, oh, hey, look, there's an opioid epidemic overwhelmingly targeting white people. And then they'll immediately jump on that. Like, well, white's a construct, right? It's something stupid. Totally. But you'd get that every now and then. But overly, where I went was pretty good.
Like, some of the, you know, in a weird way, some of like the decolonial stuff could be kind of clever and interesting here and there. But like, most of the people are just like, stupid. Like, you offer nothing. This is just boring. Anyways, what are you going to say, Nikkei?
Well, you bring up the decolonial stuff, or post-colonial, whichever.
Yeah, I don't know the difference.
And we had a... I made an appearance on the third rail on the last episode, and we had discussed the works. Like, there was an article put out on Tablet discussing Franz Fanon.
Oh, yeah.
Who's this... you know, radical.
Yeah, yeah. I know who he is.
Post anti-colonial Negro in France.
Wretched of the Earth.
Yeah, that's the one book that I read of him, which
Black
was basically
skin,
like
white masks.
You know, here we go to commit the kill whitey. But yeah, I mean, these are the kind of messaging and. Like, this is the sort of authority that's put forward as, like, an example of an intelligent and respected black academic source. You know, if you know Fanon, you know what it, you know, like, you know, the cream of the crop for the post-colonial worldview.
Yeah, I actually haven't read anything from him.
I remember reading that in university. Sociology, I think.
What did you think of Wretched?
I thought it was pretty disgusting.
Yeah, same.
But that's literally what it is. It's just revenge fantasy. It's like,
yeah, no,
it is just revenge porn. It's that's just like I'm going to kill these honkers.
Like, if you read Richard Wright, I had to read this. Like my first year of school, it's a book called Native Son from Richard Wright. It's basically like a revenge fantasy of a black guy killing whitey. Like, legit. From what I remember, it's like the main character is this guy from like Southside Chicago, and he kills a rich white communist that tries to like help him. In that way, it's kind of red-pilled, but it's like, you know, there was obviously that racial tension. Like, she doesn't understand what it's like to be black, even though she's a communist. But like the kind of general idea is like, oh, not that you should support what he did, but you got to understand why he did it, why he went and killed and murdered his girlfriend and this white lady and all this stuff and raped a dead body. Or I don't know if he did that, but he did crazy shit. And it's like, you got to understand why he did that. And it's like, maybe I don't.
Yeah,
want
to. I understand fully well why he did that. I know all I need to know just by looking at him.
I don't know. Okay, he didn't rape a dead body. That's not... But it was something, like, horrible. Like, I think he threw his girlfriend, his black girlfriend's body down, like, into a ditch, and he, like, threw a rock, and it, like... They did it in excruciating detail on her head, and, like, it was gross. It was effectively, like, something like that, and it just... I was like, what's the point of this, man?
I think it's just trying to, you know, narrate a primal... Negro urge to kill what frustrates him.
Yeah.
In Wretched of the Earth, there's like a section where it's like, we dream of like entering their house and staying in it and sleeping in their bed, preferably with their wives. It's like, whole thing is just revenge fantasy. And the justification that they give for it, it's like, well, you have to understand the psychology of the colonized and why they do the things that they do. And all that is basically doing is training a generation of people to give excuses every single time there's another rape or murder.
Yeah, no, totally.
And we see that actually happening. Like, there's ever-growing lists of cases of, you know, minority violence that and the justice system in different countries makes excuses for.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And you even have it like
super common.
Remember that Chapo Trap House Reddit post? It was on their r/Chapo Trap House Reddit. Someone said, if I get killed by an illegal immigrant, can you guys, like, is there a way I can make sure it doesn't become a talking point for the right or white nationalists?
Oh my God.
Like, it's just dripping in self-indulgent martyrdom fantasy. It's like, oh, don't let me be used by the enemy. Let my death only be used for our cause.
Yeah, it's really bad. And that's the thing that's so weird, that they're given institutional support to, like, have these revenge fantasies. Like, they get grants to do this stuff, and they have teaching positions. And in a way, I can understand, like, why some people, maybe, like, their first experience of philosophy maybe was, like, in a random public university, and so they got exposed to this stuff, and they're like, oh, this is stupid. So I can understand that. But it tarnishes the name of philosophy. It tarnishes the name of anything, even the other social sciences. Like, sociology could be interesting, but it's not now because of what it does.
Now, sociology right now is a long way from Alfred Schultz, other interesting theorists. And it does happen in philosophy too. Like, you got to pick your department very well. Like, there's one university here I won't even step foot in just because the department is such a joke. It's like, what is philosophy? It's basically like stuff you could read in the Huffington Post or BuzzFeed article. Like, this fucking passes for philosophy. Like, this is garbage. You guys shouldn't be teaching. You should be fired.
Yeah, it's crazy. What's allowed, and people?
People
go into debt for this. Like,
should totally just ghostwrite some garbage article and get paid a bunch for it, and then just funnel it back to us.
Yeah, some of these articles are
equivalent. I mean, I'm pretty sure there must be some so-called affair papers in philosophy journals.
So-called.
Oh yeah, I've seen a few.
Yeah. Well, it's like
any humorous ones you remember?
On my head, though, no.
On this show, we've talked about some guy that did like a queer analysis of like "Viva La Bam" or something like that.
Isn't there one department doing like a pop music, but not like analyzing it from an art history or critical perspective, but they're doing like the philosophy of Lady Gaga or something?
I wouldn't be surprised.
I swear I saw this. It was like the philosophy of, yeah, not like I take my inspiration from this, not like a critical look, but like,
yeah, no,
this
totally
is really my philosophy. I saw it at some department.
If I could like totally eliminate one word from academic jargon, probably be queering.
Oh, that's everywhere in all the fields. It's like,
which word?
Queering.
Queering.
To queer.
Oh yeah.
You know, I think that's one from Judith Butler. Probably.
If I could eliminate one word from journalism, it would be amazing.
Did you ever have to read any Judith Butler?
Gender Trouble. It's not very impressive.
Yeah.
What about that one?
I think
woman Bell Hooks.
Never heard of her.
I think even Judith Butler was so bad. I think even Derrida had to like basically say like, you bitches are crazy. This is not what I meant.
Yeah,
that was Derrida.
Yeah, Derrida was like, no, man. Stop. Yeah. And that's the thing, like, some of these like post-structuralists are not as, I'm not saying there are guys or anything, but they're not like the enemies we think they are. A lot of it's like the post-colonial weirdos.
Yeah, Borzoi on the last, how, you know, if Camus had read the foreword that Sartre had written for one of Fanon's books, he would have killed him.
I haven't read Camus.
Oh yeah, that's the one where Sartre said, like, have the courage to read this book.
Yes. But he was bringing up the point that since Camus was a pied noir.
He was. He would have
had particularly strong feelings about Fanon and, you know, Sartre and their connection, specifically with Fanon being like so heavily pro Algerian independence movement.
Yeah, Camus was a pied noir. Is he kind of ignored nowadays because of that?
Mostly ignored unless you're in the literature department.
Yeah, but like even there, I wonder, because I don't know. It'd be interesting to think about.
I don't think I've ever actually heard a critique of the pied noir.
Those are the French in Algeria, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any other articles you have there, Nikkei?
Yes. Clemson professor reported for warning students not to use the N-word.
Reported? For what? For not wanting... Say it again?
For warning students not to use the N-word.
Why would she report it? I don't know.
How it says, in early March 2019, a professor at Clemson University wrapped up his class by telling students they would be discussing a number of LGBTQ-related topics during the next... He noted that over the years, he had learned it was offensive for heterosexual students to use the word queer when referencing LGBTQ students, and counseled straight students not to do so. The professor's parenthetical then took a detour, and he discussed how he learned it was improper to use the N-word.
Oh, he finally learned.
Yeah. He said during college, he roomed with the head of the Black Student Union, and they got to be such good friends, he thought he could use the N-word in his presence. He learned he could not. When telling the story, the professor allegedly used the N-word 3 times, quote, twice with a hard R and once with an A, according to a student in the class. Even though he was using the word and telling students it was inappropriate to use it, the professor was then reported to administration by the student.
Jeez.
There is a growing debate, or this is a quote, there is a growing debate in today's culture that it is inappropriate to say the N-word for educational purposes, the student wrote, adding, quote, I don't feel this should be a debate. One should not utilize their position of authority and power to say words that are not appropriate for them, or that... are not appropriate for them, not professional. Okay? I don't know if there's supposed to be a comma there, but there wasn't. The quote continues, our tuition money should not be towards professors' salaries who do not take the comfort of their students seriously nor respect their sensitivity and ancestors' history. The student recommended that the professor be subject to administrational reprimanding, a public apology, and changed behavior.
I guess they're on to me because my plan was to get tenure and then I was just going to give literature where I could have an N-word pass and get away with it.
But it's so funny that he was trying, he tried to get an N-pass, but he didn't. And he's like, no, like I've had one before around Black people. Like I could say the nigga with them, you know, and some Black people are fine with that. I guess this one was too woke. Yeah, that's funny. Because I don't even know if they teach like Huckleberry Finn anymore in school. Like, because that has some hard R's in there, man.
Who reads Huck Finn in college?
No, I'm talking about, I probably should clarify. I'm talking about like in like elementary school, they still do that. They still teach that.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Yeah, it's part of the American canon.
Because me and my friends, we would just sit there and was like, look it. His name is Nigger Jim. We just laugh.
It's a good name for a cat.
Yeah, come to think of it.
Well, is there anything else you guys want to talk about? I think we've reached like an hour or 20 minutes or so. It's getting pretty hot. Kind of late. Gotta go back to some research.
I had another big question I wanted to ask our guest.
Oh yeah, that's fine.
All right, so
shoot.
How does one attempt to square the apparent circle of Marxism and theology?
Well, there is a movement in theology called liberation theology, which is largely...
I'm familiar with it, yes. It's like a mostly Latino Catholic conception. I should say Judeo-Latino, to be specific.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so you have liberation theology, which basically demythologizes the figure of Christ into a social revolutionary or like a proto-communist revolutionary. And then it's basically that the church is supposed to act as a symbol or like an agent for the colonized, and that they become, you know, they take on the Christ role of opposing colonial powers. And so that's more post-colonial, but they do have like more of a Marxist bend to it as well. Depends which liberation theologian you're reading. Like, you have the Black liberation theologians like James Cone. And then to be more specifically Marxist, you have like people like Neil Elliott to be more Marxist, or what's his name? Terry. He wrote Reason, Faith, and Revolution. He's a big name, actually. Terry Eagleton, that's him. He's one of those guys that does a combination somewhere of Marx and theology. But it's basically going along the route of, like, you know, Jesus was a social revolutionary, or he's on the side of the poor, therefore he's on the side of the communists, which of course is nonsense theologically, because it's basically bringing the church and the message of Christ into a dialectic of oppressor oppressed or bourgeois proletariat. And so judgment and then redemption only happens within the context of redistribution. So it's basically like an atheist Marxist version of theology, which really doesn't work. Right? You get to theology in the 20th century, like Karl Barth when he wrote his commentary to the Romans, which was the first text in theology, because you had before then you had the dominance of liberal theology, like from Schleiermacher taking over from Kant, and then D.F. Strauss taking over from Hegel. And so you had Protestant liberal theology, which was very susceptible later down the road to things like liberation theology. But it's only when you get to Karl Barth's commentary, then people like Hans Urs von Balthasar for the Catholic side, which is a badass name, you get this more strict apocalyptic faith of Christ is how you're saved notion, where it's not an individual choice for salvation, but a drawing up of the whole of humanity into a new reality that puts into question all of the political reality and powers insofar as they are against Christ in that reality. So it's not something where you could place it into a certain Marxist or post-colonial system, but it should be a question mark to all unjust uses of power. And that would also apply, of course, to anti-white blood libel in the neoliberal system.
Am I missing anything when I hear atheist theology and just dismiss that as a nonsensical oxymoron?
Thing to do. I mean, a lot of people, like, they don't explicitly say it's atheist, but it basically is.
But if it boils down to it, then that's, like, let's address that. Like, if you can, like, make a case for atheistic theology, then all right, I'll hear it. But if you really can't, without, you know, running into this, you know, what would seem to be an obvious contradiction, then what's the point? Is the whole premise resting on that you don't question that apparent contradiction?
It's basically resting on the idea that, like, Christ is like a archetype among others of, you know, social justice in the wider sense of the word. But I mean, it's just obvious bullshit. Like, why call it theology?
Why not just say you're not? It doesn't have to be a theological analysis of Christ. I mean, you could
theology
say
like
it's a little...
Theos. It's about God, right?
Yes. Well, that's my point. So if there are no gods, then you're not studying anything.
Yeah, it's just like, you just call it something else. But like, theology is confessional, right? So it's always with the idea that God is real, no matter which theological stance you're coming from. If you're trying to explain away Christ, saying like he's a social revolutionary, to me that would make sense if you're in like a religious studies department. But calling it theology doesn't make sense. So from a theological perspective, it's just total bullshit. postmodern theology does this too.
I'm not crazy for just assuming that.
No, like, I mean, you have postmodern theology, like, which isn't the Marxist variety, but like the John Caputo variety, where it's that there's God who may be, where in the situation in which you make a decision that's ethical for the other, then God somehow manifests between that relation. It's just complete nonsense. It's just like, well,
come on, man.
Why use theological language?
Is this really what gets passed as like valid? Like, some people take this valid.
Yeah.
Come on, give me a break. See, this is why philosophy gets discredited in people's minds. Because they hear shit like this, and it's just like, I can dismiss all of this, and I'm not missing any sort of understanding. In fact, I'm gaining more understanding in my dismissal than I am in hearing it out.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it depends on the department and what you're reading, though. Because for everything like that, if you want genuine theology, look to post-liberal theology. Like, look to Karl Barth. Look at radical orthodoxy, right? Look at theopolitics today. Like, that's a really interesting field of theology. Or just look to actual philosophy that's not overly done with an agenda. Like, looking at philosophy from, say, a philosophy of mind perspective or phenomenology or more straightforward political philosophy. Like, there's plenty of good places to go in the department, but the problem is these big names, they just stick out. And so that's a lot of people's first exposure because it sells more books, right? Because it's more provocative. So that's what they put on places. But the genuine stuff is definitely there. You just got to know where to find it.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah. Well, I got a few things I need to do, so I think it's good to put a bookmark here. I don't know if Richard Spencer still says this, but he used to say that back in the day.
Yeah, he does. He said it earlier today.
Yeah. You know what? Because like I watch like till like the last 5 seconds. I don't watch because I know what it's gonna say. So I haven't heard him like actually say it in a while. Because like when I'm done with the Mick Spencer group or something like that, I'm like, okay, there's 5 seconds ago. And it's done. I don't need to listen to what he, you know, the end. So he probably still says it. I just don't know.
You want to reiterate your plug?
Yeah, you can find EBL if you want to learn good philosophy, that is, not the and theology. If you don't want to learn the shitty stuff that we were just talking about a few minutes ago, watch EBL on rating. And when it is something shitty, we take it apart pretty well. But yeah, so go to NPI Radix channel. You can find EBL there if you like cinema and stuff like that. We have ECL on my own channel, which is Thamster Witnat. That's Euro Cinephile Lounge. Me and Fashi Zizek, that's a little more of a relaxed show where we just analyze films. I have some solo videos in the works, which would be nice. Good coming up on my own channel as well, so I could deal with more specific topics in detail from my own perspective rather than mediating a conversation among people on a panel. So that stuff will be on my channel as well soon. Then you can find me on Twitter, Thamster Widnat. And the last thing is I now am the editor for the Radix Journal, and we're launching two other journals underneath that name, which will be coming up soon. So those are all the places you can find me.
If awesome. I was only going to listen to one episode of EBL and what was the other one? CDL? CBL?
ECL.
ECL. If I was only going to listen to one episode of each, what should it be?
For EBL, I would actually say, I'll give a bit of a cheap answer, but in 2 weeks from now, we're doing Martin Heidegger on the question concerning technology, which is, we've been requested to do this one for a long time. So that's probably the one to look out for. Right. In terms of ones that are already done, I think the one we did on Slavoj Žižek was a really good one. The one we did on Dugin was really good. Well, actually, they're all good, but yeah, just go to the Heidegger one in a couple of weeks because there's a lot of anticipation for that one, so I'll just pump that one again. But I would encourage everyone to go through the backlog. For ECL, I would say the review that we did of the movie Parasite was a really strong review.
Worth watching before listening?
Actually, if I want to force people to watch a movie, watch the review we did for the Japanese film House. And then you'll have to watch that movie. because that's quite the insane movie, to say the least. It's hard to describe it, but it'd be fun if people had to watch that movie.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for coming on.
Fun.
All right, well, we'll see you guys in a week, two, who knows. All right.
Cheers.
Peace out.
Thanks for listening.